Chapter 47. Before the waitress had shut the door, I had forgotten how many stagecoaches she said used to change horses in the town every day. But it was of little moment. Any high number would do as well as another. It had been a great stagecoaching town in the great stagecoaching times, and the ruthless railways had killed and buried it. The sign of the house was the dolphin's head. Why only head, I don't know, for the dolphin's effigy at full length, and upside down as a dolphin is always bound to be when artistically treated, though I suppose he is sometimes right side upward in his natural condition, graced the signboard. The signboard chafed its rusty hooks outside the bow window of my room, and was a shabby work. No visitor could have denied that the dolphin was dying by inches, but he showed no bright colors. He had once served another master. There was a newer streak of paint below him, displaying with inconsistent freshness the legend, by J. Mellows. My door opened again, and J. Mellows' representative came back. I had asked her what I could have for dinner, and she now returned with the counter question, what would I like? As the dolphin stood possessed of nothing that I do like, I was fain to yield to the suggestion of a duck, which I don't like. J. Mellows' representative was a mournful young woman with eye susceptible of guidance, and one uncontrollable eye, which latter, seeming to wander in quest of stagecoaches, deepened the melancholy in which the dolphin was steeped. This young woman had but shut the door on retiring again, when I bethought me of adding to my order the words, with nice vegetables. Apostrophe looking out at the door, to give them emphatic utterance, I found her already in a state of pensive catalepsy in the deserted gallery, picking her teeth with a pin. At the railway station 7 miles off, I had been the subject of wonder when I ordered a fly-in which to come here. And when I gave the direction to the dolphin's head, apostrophe I had observed an ominous stare on the countenance of the strong young man in velveteen, who was the platform servant of the company. He had also called to my driver at parting, "All right, don't hang yourself when you get there, G-O-O-G. ..." in a sarcastic tone, for which I had entertained some transitory thoughts of reporting him to the general manager. I had no business in the town. I never have any business in any town, but I had been caught by the fancy that I would come and look at it in its degeneracy. My purpose was fitly inaugurated by the dolphin's head, which everywhere expressed past coachfulness and present coachlessness. Colored prints of coaches, starting, arriving, changing horses, coaches in the sunshine, coaches in the snow, coaches in the wind, coaches in the mist and rain, coaches on the king's birthday, coaches in all circumstances compatible with their triumph and victory, but never in the act of breaking down or overturning, pervaded the house. Of these works of art, some, framed and not glazed, had holes in them. The varnish of others had become so brown and cracked that they looked like overdone pie crust. The designs of others were almost obliterated by the flies of many summers. Broken glasses, damaged frames, lopsided hanging, and consignment of incurable cripples to places of refuge in dark corners attested the desolation of the rest. The old room on the ground floor, where the passengers of the Highflyer used to dine, had nothing in it but a wretched show of twigs and flower pots in the broad window, to hide the nakedness of the land, and in a corner little Mellow's perambulator, with even its parasol head turned despondently to the wall. The other room, where Post Horse Company used to wait while relays were getting ready down the yard, still held its ground, but was as airless as I conceive a hearse to be, insomuch that Mr. Pitt, hanging high against the partition with spots on him like port wine, though it is mysterious how port wine ever got squirted up there, had good reason for perking his nose and sniffing. The stopperless cruets on the spindle shank sideboard were in a miserably dejected state. The anchovy sauce having turned blue some years ago, and the cayenne pepper with a scoop in it like a small model of a wooden leg, having turned solid. The old fraudulent candles which were always being paid for and never used, were burned out at last. but their tall stilts of candlesticks still lingered, and still outraged the human intellect, by pretending to be silver. The moldy old unreformed borough member, with his right hand buttoned up in the breast of his coat, and his back characteristically turned on bales of petitions from his constituents, was there too. And the poker which never had been among the fire irons, lest post-horse company should overstir the fire, was not there, as of old. Pursuing my researches in the dolphin's head, I found it sorely shrunken. When J. Mellows came into possession, he had walled off half the bar, which was now a tobacco shop with its own entrance in the yard, the once glorious yard where the post boys, whip in hand and always buttoning their waistcoats at the last moment, used to come running forth to mount and away. A scientific shoeing smith and veterinary surgeon, apostrophe had further encroached upon the yard, and a grimly satirical jobber, who announced himself as having to let a neat one-horse fly, and a one-horse cart, apostrophe had established his business, himself, and his family, in a part of the extensive stables. Another part was lopped clean off from the dolphin's head, and now comprised a chapel, a wheelwright's, and a young men's mutual improvement and discussion society in a loft, colon the whole forming a back lane. No audacious hand had plucked down the vane from the central cupola of the stables, but it had grown rusty, and stuck at end nil. While the score or two of pigeons, that remained true to their ancestral traditions and the place, had collected in a row on the roof ridge of the only outhouse retained by the dolphin, where all the inside pigeons tried to push the outside pigeon off. This I accepted as emblematical of the struggle for post and place in railway times. Sauntering forth into the town, by way of the covered and pillared entrance to the dolphin's yard, once redolent of soup and stable litter, now redolent of moldy disuse, I paced the street. It was a hot day, and the little sunblinds of the shops were all drawn down, and the more enterprising tradesmen had caused their prentices to trickle water on the pavement appertaining to their frontage. It looked as if they had been shedding tears for the stage coaches, and drying their ineffectual pocket handkerchiefs. Such weakness would have been excusable, for business was as one dejected porkman who kept a shop which refused to reciprocate the compliment by keeping him, informed me bitter bad. Apostrophe most of the harness makers and corn dealers were gone the way of the coaches, but it was a pleasant recognition of the eternal procession of children down that old original steep incline, the valley of the shadow, that those tradesmen were mostly succeeded by vendors of sweetmeats and cheap toys. The opposition house to the Dolphin, once famous as the New White Hart, had long collapsed. In a fit of abject depression, it had cast whitewash on its windows, and boarded up its front door, and reduced itself to a side entrance. But even that had proved a world too white for the literary institution which had been its last phase, for the institution had collapsed too, and of the ambitious letters of its inscription on the White Hart's front, all had fallen off but these. L-Y-N-T, suggestive of lamentably insolvent. As to the neighboring marketplace, it seemed to have wholly relinquished marketing, to the dealer in crockery whose pots and pans straggled half across it, and to the cheap jack who sat with folded arms on the shafts of his cart, superciliously gazing around, his velveteen waistcoat, evidently harboring grave doubts, whether it was worth his while to stay a night in such a place. The church bells began to ring as I left this spot, but they by no means improved the case, for they said, in a petulant way, and speaking with some difficulty in their irritation, "What's become of the coaches?" Apostrophe apostrophe nor would they, I found on listening, ever vary their emphasis, save in respect of growing more sharp and vexed, but invariably went on, "What's become of the coaches?" Apostrophe apostrophe always beginning the inquiry with an unpolite abruptness. Perhaps from their elevation they saw the railway, and it aggravated them. Coming upon a coachmaker's workshop, I began to look about me with a revived spirit, thinking that perchance I might behold there some remains of the old times of the town's greatness. There was only one man at work, a dry man, grizzled, and far advanced in years, but tall and upright, who, becoming aware of me looking on, straightened his back, pushed up his spectacles against his brown paper cap, and appeared inclined to defy me, to whom I pacifically said, "Good day, sir." What? Said he. "Good day, sir." He seemed to consider about that, and not to agree with me. Was you a looking for anything? He then asked, in a pointed manner. I was wondering whether there happened to be any fragment of an old stagecoach here. Is that all? That's all. No, there ain't. It was now my turn to say oh. And I said it. Not another word did the dry and grizzled man say, but went to his work again. In the coach-making days, the coach-painters had tried their brushes on a post beside him, and quite a calendar of departed glories was to be read upon it, in blue and yellow and red and green, some inches thick. Presently he looked up again. "You seem to have a deal of time on your hands," was his querulous remark. I admitted the fact. "I think it's a pity you was not brought up to something," said he. I said I thought so too. Appearing to be informed with an idea, he laid down his plane, for it was a plane he was at work with, pushed up his spectacles again, and came to the door. "Would a pochet do for you?" he asked. "I am not sure that I understand what you mean." "Would a pochet," said the coachmaker, standing close before me, unfolding his arms in the manner of a cross-examining counsel, "would a pochet meet the views you have expressed? Yes, or no?" "Yes." "Then you keep straight along down there till you see one. You will see one, if you go fur enough." With that, he turned me by the shoulder in the direction I was to take, and went in, and resumed his work against a background of leaves and grapes. For, although he was a soured man and a discontented, his workshop was that agreeable mixture of town and country, street and garden, which is often to be seen in a small English town. I went the way he had turned me, and I came to the beer shop with the sign of the first and last, and was out of the town on the old London road. I came to the turnpike, and I found it, in its silent way, eloquent respecting the change that had fallen on the road. The turnpike house was all overgrown with ivy, and the turnpike keeper, unable to get a living out of the tolls, plied the trade of a cobbler. Not only that, but his wife sold ginger beer, and, in the very window of espial through which the toll takers of old times used with awe, to behold the grand London coaches coming on at a gallop, exhibited for sale little barber's poles of sweet stuff in a sticky lantern. The political economy of the master of the turnpike thus expressed itself. "How goes turnpike business, master?" said I to him, as he sat in his little porch, repairing a shoe. "It don't go at all, master," said he to me. "It's stopped." "That's bad," said one. "Bad?" he repeated. And he pointed to one of his sunburned, moldy children who was climbing the turnpike gate, and said, extending his open right hand in remonstrance with universal nature, "Five on 'em." "But how to improve turnpike business?" said one. "There's a way, master," said he, with the air of one who had thought deeply on the subject. "I should like to know it." "Lay a toll on everything as comes through, lay a toll on walkers. Lay another toll on everything as don't come through, lay a toll on them as stops at home." "Would the last remedy be fair?" "Fair? Them as stops at home, could come through if they liked, couldn't they? Apostrophe apostrophe, say they could. Apostrophe, told them. If they don't come through, it's their lookout. Anyways, told them. Apostrophe apostrophe, finding it was as impossible to argue with this financial genius, as if he had been Chancellor of the Exchequer, and consequently the right man in the right place, I passed on meekly. My mind now began to misgive me, that the disappointed coachmaker had sent me on a wild goose errand, and that there was no postchaise in those parts. But coming within view of certain allotment gardens by the roadside, I retracted the suspicion, and confessed that I had done a man injustice. For, there I saw, surely, the poorest superannuated postchaise left on earth. It was a postchaise taken off its axle tree and wheels, and plumped down on the clay soil among a ragged growth of vegetables. It was a postchaise, not even set straight upon the ground, but tilted over, as if it had fallen out of a balloon. It was a postchaise that had been a long time in those decayed circumstances, and against which scarlet beans were trained. It was a postchaise patched and mended with old tea trays, or with scraps of iron, that looked like them, and boarded up, as to the windows, but having a knocker on the offside door. Whether it was a postchaise used as tool house, summer house, or dwelling house, I could not discover, for there was nobody at home at the postchaise when I knocked, but it was certainly used for something, and locked up. In the wonder of this discovery, I walked round and round the postchaise many times, and sat down by the postchaise, waiting for further elucidation. None came. At last, I made my way back to the old London road by the further end of the allotment gardens, and consequently at a point beyond that from which I had diverged. I had to scramble through a hedge, and down a steep bank, and I nearly came down a top of a little spare man who sat breaking stones by the roadside. He stayed his hammer, and said, regarding me mysteriously through, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.